special edition of the Experienced Arden and the Exec MBA podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty, and you are listening to a new episode. On this episode of the podcast, I'm excited to share a recording of a live event we recently hosted featuring none other than Darden faculty member Rich Evans. During this conversation, we touch on a lot of topics, including Rich's background, what brought him to Darden, what he enjoys about teaching finance through the case method, and even some hot topics in finance, including GameStop, where Rich sees the market going, and a lot more. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here is my interview with Rich Evans. Rich, how are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me, Brent.
Maybe give you a chance to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit more about who you are and your background.
You bet, Brett. So I am one of the finance faculty here at the Darden School. I teach the investments class and then a follow-on called quantitative portfolio management. I have worked with the Mayo Center for Asset Management, one of the centers of excellence here at Darden. And in the past, I've been the advisor to Darden Capital Management. So we have a student-run, actually multiple student-run funds. They manage about $20 million of the endowment. And as an advisor, you get to be involved in that process. Although unlike other places, it wasn't like they suggested things, then I made decisions. I literally was the advisor. On occasion, they'd buy stuff I thought was a terrible idea, but usually I was wrong, which is why I'm a professor and not a practitioner. So,
and what brought you to Darden? I always enjoy this question because I mean, it's so fascinating to hear about our faculty members' professional journeys to this particular moment. And many of them have been at the Darden School for a number of years, yourself included. So what brought you here?
So I did my PhD at Wharton, and my experience there was the faculty did their very best to make sure that they could minimize their teaching responsibilities, right? So I was really about research, 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 which as a PhD student was fantastic. But while I was there, there was a visiting faculty member, a guy named Matt McBrady, who had just completed his PhD at Harvard and was going to, you know, wait a year and then go on the finance job market. Anyway, so he came in and was teaching this kind of corporate finance elective for the MBA students. The first time he taught it, nobody had ever heard of him, right? Because he was a visiting faculty member. And so his class the enrollment for his class wasn't very high, but he was a superstar. Like right off the bat, the students thought, this guy is amazing. So his office wasn't too far from where the cubicles where the PhD students were at Wharton. And so I interacted with him a bunch and really got to know him and like him and kind of liked his approach to research, teaching, the whole academic thing. And so he actually came to Darden. That was his first placement. So when I was on the job market, he reached out and said, hey, it's Matt here. What do you think? And, you know, I knew nothing about the University of Virginia or the Darden School of Business at that point, but came to Charlottesville and was enchanted. I actually didn't come here first. So I made, you know, first time around, I made a mistake, but 3 years later, they made me another offer and I wised up and came down to Charlottesville. And I've been here, I think 14 or 15 years now. I love this place.
Well, one of the sort of question lines that we got in terms of the questions that were submitted in advance for this session is kind of along the lines of what's it like to teach finance in the case method? I think for prospective students, people think about finance, or I should probably say it in the Darden pronunciation, finance. I think that might actually be the most appropriate way to pronounce it. So what's it like to teach finance through the case method? Because people think of this as sort of more of a technical thing, and yet case method is about decision making and sort of bringing a narrative and kind of working collectively towards a decision. So how do you think about that?
So, Brent, I'm glad you pointed out that it's finance, not finance. So when I was a PhD at Wharton, one of the senior faculty members who had actually worked on Wall Street for a number of years, he said, look, finance is lowbrow, but finance is very highbrow. And so it's important you pronounce it like that. That is key. But, you think about case method, and to me, this is exactly the right way to teach finance. Okay, so I've got a quantitative skill. So, for example, for my investments class, we assess whether managers of, you know, a fund manager is good or bad. And one of the things we use is the capital asset pricing model, so this factor model. And you think, well, you know, Case, why would I use that? Well, there'll be a technical note, which is a very precise explanation of this quantitative tool, how it works. And, you know, my experience as an undergrad was I'd often have a professor who would assign five chapters worth of reading. Now, it turns out there was only about a paragraph worth of stuff that I really needed to read, but it was interspersed throughout the five chapters. This is not like that. These are precise, direct, to the point. And it's about the skill itself. Now, the key is when you come to class, you understand the quantitative skill and you have a theoretical understanding And then we help translate that into practice, right? So actually, you know, calculating the CAPM, not really as important as understanding what that information tells you at the end of the day. So for any of these tools, right, you learn it and then you apply it in reality, right? We give you an example where you're choosing, right? You're an endowment or a pension fund and you're trying to pick amongst five different managers, right? And you assess all of them using this tool. And then we have this conversation in class about a real world complex decision that's, you know, in many ways, much more important than just can I use this quantitative tool or not?
Well, Rich, I appreciate that. One of the things that, you know, obviously, so you're talking about everybody coming together, looking at the same problem. And one of the great things about the Darden classroom is that you have people from a lot of different backgrounds. Oftentimes you'll have people in the same class who, some of whom have deep experience in the area related to the discussion. Other people are much earlier in their journey learning about this and just kind of getting oriented to this information for the first time. How do you design a class? Okay, how do you lead a case discussion to make sure that it's engaging for everybody, the more experienced folks in the room and the more novice people with respect to the topic?
Yeah, so my investments elective is a good example of that, in that about a third of the students in the second year take it. And you'll have people in that class who've literally managed money before. They might be managing money right now with Darden Capital Management. We've had students who have left and immediately after school started managing their own fund, right? So then you also have other individuals who came from totally different backgrounds, right? They were a teacher before, or an engineer, or, you know, no finance or investing background, but are really interested because they recognize as soon as you get to that next job, you got to figure out which funds you want to invest in your 401k. So the course is designed. So first of all, I come to the classroom having a great understanding of the backgrounds of all the individuals, right? So I have a copy of their resume and evaluate it and get a sense of, you know, who is an expert and who may not be an expert in the subject. Now we build, right? So the first case we do, say the first module of that course is about asset allocation. And the first case is really simple. And so my cold calls for that first case will be drawn largely from people who are novices to the area, right? Get them engaged, excited, interested about it. And as they proceed through that first module, the last case of that first module is very complex. And so even, you know, whether it's throughout the course itself or even within the discussion, right, you know, you have some sense of where people are, their initial expertise, you know, how they've progressed in the course. Who can I ask to push them just above the level that they're at? At the same time, you've got these other experts in the classroom, right? Why have me or any professor lecture about something when I've got someone in the room who's worked for, you know, a big hedge fund or who's been in a private equity or venture capital shop? And I can call on them and they can give us their experience, their background, their perspective on these things. So it's, I mean, a lot of it comes down to understanding who's in the classroom, what their expertise is. And with the case method, I'm constantly checking in to see who's following and who's not. And like I said, the aim is every class to stretch you just a little farther than we did the class before.
So if you're listening to what Rich is saying here, understand that faculty don't just walk into the classroom and say, well, let's talk about this case. What do y'all think's going on here? A lot of pre-work that goes in. And so let's talk about the faculty role in the case method, because I think this is one of the interesting things. So you're a subject matter expert. You have a lot of experience and expertise to offer. And yet when faculty come into the classroom, they're in that Socratic mode, asking questions, bringing people into the conversation. How do you think of your role in a case discussion?
Oh, if I can get a conversation started amongst students, not just about anything, but about, you know, the case that day and it's progressing in their learning, it's a beautiful thing. So when I'm teaching, if I can get them to start to engage each other, I'll actually physically almost remove myself from the room. I'll start to slink away into the corner. I'll even literally turn away from the classroom because I would rather have them teaching each other and learning from each other, right? It's one thing for me to teach you something, but Brett, if you can then take that concept and teach it to somebody else, then you have truly mastered it, right? And so it's those conversations, that level of engagement that leads to true learning. It's not somebody lecturing at you. It's you trying to explain to your classmates what this particular, you know, financial instrument is or risk or concept, you know, whatever it happens to be.
What do you do? This is a question that we got in advance, and I thought it was a great question. What do you do when students are talking and you can kind of feel the conversation going maybe in a direction that's different than where it maybe should be heading? I don't want to say wrong direction, but maybe not exactly the right direction.
So now, to be clear, Brett and his team do such an amazing job. The Darden students never go in the wrong direction, right? So let me talk theoretically as opposed to practice. No, so it happens, right? Actually, just a couple of weeks ago, I asked this question and I got the total wrong answer, and the conversation sort of got legs of its own. And so now I'm looking around the room as this conversation's occurring, and I see somebody in the back who I think is following and is looking really skeptical. Now, everybody else seems excited about this wrong idea. I think, well, what can we do to turn this around, right? So there's a pause in the conversation, and I turn to him and I say sort of skeptically, like, do you really think this is true? Do you think they're right about this? And so he was hesitant at first, but he started to describe how he saw it and the underlying economics and how this should work. And he was spot on, right? And so he explained it, and then two of these other students who, thought they were thinking the wrong way said, wait a second, how about this? And then he explained the right way, and then they asked him again. And so basically, he convinced them of the opposite, at which point, the conversation was back on track. And you think, well, wait a second, you just wasted a bunch of time. But we didn't, right? We explored this probability space of the right and the wrong. And when the students now understand what is wrong and why it's wrong, they actually have a better understanding of the overall subject matter.
So we talked about the faculty role. What do you see as the student's role or responsibility, or how to, what do you expect from students in terms of the case discussions?
So to come prepared and to do their best, right? Now, doing your best doesn't mean that you know all the answers or you get it right. Right? In fact, one of the things I love is I'll often, when we're sharing in the investments course, there are a number of places where we do regressions or optimization. So people need to share their spreadsheets. And you think, well, let's have the person who's going to do it perfect share their spreadsheet. But there's almost no learning if that's the case. Right? So if you come and do your best and get it all wrong, I'm enthralled. Right? Because we can learn with you. We can go on that journey with you to get it right and to think about what assumptions and what things you need to change to understand this concept. So it's really not about being an expert. It's about doing your best and coming prepared and with a willingness to share and to listen to the ideas of others, right? I mean, that collective conversation is really how learning occurs.
Well, that kind of sets us up for our sort of transitioning now to your research and thinking about diversity and sort of background. And one of the things I've enjoyed about preparing for these conversations is I'm getting to read people's articles, or at least abridged versions of people's articles. And an article that you wrote back in March of 2020, or that was on Darden's Ideas to Action website, related to political polarization and in investment teams. And what an interesting conversation for our particular moment, at least here in the United States. Pretty extreme times, a big gap between the two principal parties here in the US. And so, maybe high level, you want to share sort of what you learned through this study?
Yeah, so we look at mutual fund manager teams, and the idea is to think about diversity and its impact on a team. Now, there are different dimensions of diversity in the academic literature, and I think most often when we say diversity, we think of characteristic diversity, right? So race, gender, nationality, sexual orientation, so characteristics of the person. There's also functional diversity, and often when teams are formed at Darden, we think who has background in accounting, right? Who has a background in finance, marketing, who is a teacher, right? Who is international? And so then the last dimension is ideological, right? Now, ideology may connect to both of those other dimensions, but political affiliation is a very specific measure of ideological diversity. And so what we do is we look at these mutual fund manager teams that consist of, Democrats and Republicans at the same time. Now, you think, okay, do I really need to, is that really important? It turns out it is, right? If you've got two different individuals on a team who have very different views of the economic world, there's this long literature, diversity literature, not just for asset management, across industries that suggest a diverse team can make better decisions. Now, there's a really important caveat to that, which is it only works if the two parties with different perspectives trust each other, right? So we find that often we're more likely to hang out with people who are very similar to us, right? That homogeneity is comfortable. And so the question is, if you put me in a team with somebody who's so different than I am and thinks differently, will we listen to each other? Will we trust each other? So we find that these diverse, ideologically diverse mutual fund manager teams outperform on average. But there's a caveat. If you measure political polarization within a given state, so imagine the investment advisors in California versus New York versus Boston, as political polarization goes up in that particular state, this benefit of diversity, right, of diverse perspectives generating better ideas, better performance, actually goes away. I mean, we literally see that individuals, if you stop trusting, right, this polarization bleeds into the workplace and you don't like the Democrats or the Republicans, whoever's opposite of you, you stop listening, right? And that value add goes away. So the same team in a low polarization time does great. And then in a high polarization time, they do much worse at the end of the day.
So much of what happens at Darden is about helping students grow as leaders and as managers. And one of the things you just noted there is that perhaps the manager and the leader of team has a role in establishing trust and norms. And I think about the Darden classroom, that's what happens in the classroom, right? There's norm setting and all of this. Are these things that you're talking about with students in class, you know, obviously you're leading investment classes, all these kinds of things, but it sounds like there's a management element to it as well.
Oh, there is. I think about that team-based experience, right? So if I lecture to you, you're a student in the classroom and you just listen to what I have to say, then the only person you need to appreciate their perspective is me, right? And if I'm like you, there's no real learning on that dimension. If I'm not like you, maybe there is. But if I put you in learning teams like we do in the first year, and you've got this group of individuals who are different from you, both in terms of their characteristics, their functional background, possibly their ideology, you know, the geography, what country they're from, et cetera. And you have to start to work together. You get this sense of, wow, if I listen to somebody else, right, we make, at the end of the day, we'll come up with a better answer to the question. Now, our chief diversity officer here, one of my colleagues in the management area, Martin Davidson, has this great book about diversity. And it talks a lot about one of the most important things into developing a culture that values and appreciates diversity, right? Really an inclusive culture is setting the incentives correctly. So, okay, we put you in this team with a bunch of other people, right, who may be different from you on these dimensions. And then we make class participation, right? So the answer that you share and your ability to contribute to the discussion, an important component of your grade, right? So we've just incentivized you to try and get along with this team. And in doing that, my experience has been by the second year, those barriers just disappear. People realize, wow, it is helpful to listen to someone who's totally different because they may have really important insights that I couldn't come up with on my own at the end of the day.
One of the things that's interesting about Darden's faculty's research is related to sort of how closely tied in they are with practitioners and with what's happening in industry. This came up in an earlier sort of Ask Me Anything session we had with Yael Grushka-Kakane, who is the Senior Associate Dean for Professional Programs. And she was talking about how many of her sort of research ideas and how much of her research work comes from sort of industry and practitioners. And so I was curious what this looks like in your research and where do your ideas come from?
Oh, I agree. So we have a number of events. We have this campus up in DC, which is fantastic. It's really beautiful. And so whether we get them down to Charlottesville or up to DC, I mean, having speakers in the class is really common. And so the nice thing about that is it helps with class, gives a different perspective. They can participate in this discussion with the students, but then we'll have lunch with them and the students, right? Or a coffee hour afterwards. And I find my most compelling research ideas are when, you know, the academic literature thinks of it one way and the practitioner I'm talking to, who's an expert in the field, thinks of it a totally different way, right? So that orthogonality is where I usually find the best ideas. Why is there such a, you know, a difference in how one literature versus, you know, this other individual perceive this particular concept? So I constantly find too, as I'm discussing papers at conferences or acting as a referee for other academic papers, having feedback from practitioners, and my sense is they too value the insights we have to offer as well. But that communication with both sides is powerful. It moves practice forward. It definitely moves the academic research forward. And most importantly, I think for our classroom, it helps me to be more informed about issues and contribute to that discussion in a Darden classroom.
Well, speaking of sort of things that are going on real time, we got some advanced questions sort of along sort of these hot topic lines. And so one of the topics that I will say, gosh, like I said, I had to do some research here. And one of the things I was asked about was SPACs, or are SPACs, I'm not sure, I guess it's plural, SPACs. And so for some of our listeners here, viewers, they may know exactly what a SPAC is. For other people, maybe like myself, not as familiar with SPACs. So what, first and foremost, what is a SPAC?
Yeah, so special purpose acquisition company. So it's this pretty unique and unusual financing vehicle. Now, they've been around for a long time. Actually, they had their antecedents in the 1980s with some particularly sketchy sort of vehicles, to be honest. But they've been used in many ways like an IPO, right? So if you think about an IPO, initial public offering, I've got a private company who wants to grow. And so they issue public stock and they get a bunch more capital and they're able to build their factory or expand their, you know, distribution network or whatever they need that capital for, right? So I think of an IPO as a company trying to find money. A SPAC is actually money trying to find a company. So a SPAC is also a publicly traded company. It has an IPO, but the company itself is just a pool of money from investors looking to acquire a private company. Now, so why do these things exist? For a number of reasons. I think one of the most important is in some ways it's a regulatory arbitrage. So if I want to file an IPO in the US, I'm not an IPO expert, but I think it's like 3 years worth of audited financial statements. I think you can do two under certain conditions, but think, you know, 3 years. Now, if I'm going to have 3 years of audited financial statements, I have to exist for a few more years before that. So maybe 5 years until I can file an IPO. Now, in the 80s, the 90s, you know, the progress of companies, the initial cost of building a company, that may make sense. But we're in a day and an age where a genius idea can become a company a lot quicker than that, right? So a SPAC was a way. In many dimensions, it was a way to avoid that, you know, long-term regulatory cost, because you do the IPO for the SPAC, you then acquire this private company that doesn't have 3 years of audited financial statements, but has a great idea and great opportunities. In some ways, it was a quicker way to get to market. Now, it's interesting to me, if you look at the number of SPACs, right? So just like we have IPOs, there are initial public offerings of these special purpose acquisition companies over time. The last time we saw a peak in SPACs was in about 2007, just before the global financial crisis. So while they serve a real purpose, right? And it is, like I said, a regulatory arbitrage. Recent SPACs by, you know, A-Rod and Shaq and Scott Armstrong, I think, is that the astronaut? Anyway, there's a bunch of these that make me start to wonder if this is, you know, maybe not as an efficient and sensible investment choice as, you know, as they might be at other times in a market cycle, for example. So, like I said, serves a real purpose. At the same time, we're seeing a huge spike in these things. A lot of competition for the same private companies between these SPACs and private equity and venture capital firms that makes me worry that, you know, they may buy a company. You know, they've got this money. They got 2 years to find a company and acquire it. The question is, what price are they going to pay for that company? Will it wind up being a good investment for the SPAC investors? So I'm getting more skeptical by the day, as it were.
Something for us to watch closely. 2007, that is an interesting date to sort of reflect upon and where things were in the financial markets. So I mentioned this earlier, we got to talk about it. GameStop, the story has already, can we believe this, been optioned by a number of media companies, Netflix included, possibly coming to a small screen and a big screen near you. So there's so many dimensions and storylines to this whole saga around GameStop and Robinhood. To you, what are some of the storylines that really jump out that you think are most interesting?
So I got to tell you a story about GameStop. So my nephew, who's out in California, called me the other day, and I was helping my kids, so I didn't answer the call, but he left me a message. He said, "Uncle Rich, you're famous." And I was like, "Of course I'm famous, but no, which dimension of famous do you mean?" And so he, you know, I texted him back. And so he said, "Look, I was on Reddit." So he does some day trading. And so he was on Reddit and GameStop. I've done a bunch of research on short selling and manipulative short selling, not just of stocks, but of exchange traded funds as well. And it turns out GameStop is part of the story. There's another ETF called XRT, which is a consumer retail ETF that was a big holder of GameStop as well. And so I think there's really two storylines here in particular, more than that, but two that are, I think, from my research background are particularly interesting. So one is the short squeeze. I mean, this is a quintessential example of one of the big risks of being a short seller. Like, you're a hedge fund, you're shorting GameStop, you think the, you know, the fundamentals of the business don't support the current price. The problem is, if you have a surge of interest, like you did from the Wall Street Bets investors, moving the price up, at some point as a short seller, you have to cover, right? You've lost money, you got to get out of the position. And the way you close out a short position is by buying the stock. So you can imagine this cascading series of short positions where one short seller says, okay, that's enough pain for me. So they buy the stock, driving the price a little higher, which triggers another short seller saying, okay, that's enough pain for me. They buy it, you know, covering their position, driving it a little bit higher, and it just cascading, driving the price incredibly high. So I think the short squeeze is, it's a real phenomenon. It's a genuine risk for short sellers. And this is a quintessential example. Now, the other side of it is the potential for manipulative short selling in both GameStop and XRT. So this is where my nephew's conversation comes in. So Reddit had this thread that referenced a talk I gave at a big conference in New York in 2016 or so, where I had talked about this concept, in particular as it relates to ETFs. And so since then, I've been getting all these emails from people on Reddit. And if you're on the call today, I apologize, I have not responded. I'm in the midst of my crazy teaching. And to be honest, my students come first. So I'm dying to engage in this because I think I know something about it. I have something to say about it. But in particular, when I think about GameStop and, you know, is there manipulative short selling there? So I wrote a paper at the very beginning of my academic career about something called failing to deliver. Right, so fails. And so what is failing to deliver? Well, in normal securities markets, imagine, Brett, that you want to you own a share of GameStop, and you want to sell that share of GameStop, and I want to buy that share of GameStop. So you would sell it, I would buy it, you know, and we agree at some time. And today we've got settlement of T+2. So two trading days later, you know, you'd get my money and I'd get the share of GameStop. We're good to go. Now it happens, and it's an infrequent thing, but on occasion something gets messed up in the plumbing of this securities clearing, as it were. So you sell it to me, I buy it, you know, the money is going to go towards you, but at T+2, the share doesn't show up. That's called a failure to deliver. Now, there are some logical explanations for fails. On occasion, you know, the custody is tricky, or it turns out that you can, especially for ETFs, you can fail to deliver if you're providing liquidity in the market. But we saw just before the global financial crisis a dramatic rise in these failures to deliver in stocks that was indicative of something much more nefarious, right? So naked short selling. So it turns out if you want to short sell a stock, you're supposed to identify where you're going to borrow that share from. Right, so say you're short selling today, Brett, and I don't mean to vilify you because you may get a bunch of emails about how you can't believe you're short selling GameStop, or you're a horrible person. But anyway, so let's make it some other stock. You're going to short sell Apple, right? You're supposed to be able to identify, it's called a locate, where that share comes from. So you identify it in advance, you know where it's coming from, you agree to sell it to me, even though you don't have the share yet, knowing that when, you know, clearing comes around, you're going to have that share and you'll deliver it to me. Now, if I were, you know, so one concern is if people can't identify, they can't find a source, can they go ahead and short sell anyway? You're not supposed to. And if you do, it'll wind up being one of these fails to deliver. So if you look at the fails to deliver around GameStop, right when it got up to 400, it spikes, you know, we're talking a bigger than 2 standard deviation move in the fails you would see over the previous couple of years for GameStop. Now, I can't say that's proof positive of manipulative short selling, but it's surprising. Like, it's hard for me to imagine a logical explanation aside from that, although there may be one. Like I said, I've looked a little bit into the data. I need to spend more time thinking about it. So now, it's not just GameStop, right? So there's this ETF called XRT that is focused on consumer retail, but it turned out GameStop got so big, it was actually had a pretty big ownership in GameStop. And similarly, a few days after that spike in the fails of GameStop, you see a spike in the fails of this particular ETF. So like I said, I can't say for sure that's abusive short selling. At the same time, both of those pretty dramatic spikes and fails make you worry about, you know, maybe somebody was doing this and not following all the regulations at the same time.
Something to look into further, perhaps. So for some of our listeners, I'm always struck by the fact that in finance, there are some jargon, there's abbreviations. Some people may be wondering, what's an ETF? And just want to make sure everybody's on the same page. So how do you explain ETFs and what they do? And, you know, I know this is an area of expertise. We could probably have a whole topic discussion around this, but sure, maybe kind of give some people some explanation around what an ETF is.
So that's a great question. We actually had this summer, we were, you know, post beginning of the pandemic, trying to find a way to engage our students and maintain this wonderful community we have here at Darden. So I actually hosted a webinar that was called Fun with ETFs. Now, I don't know if ETFs are fun for anybody else, but they are for me. I love ETFs. I'm fascinated by them as a financial instrument. But an ETF is an exchange traded fund. And big picture, it's quite similar to an index fund or another portfolio. So it's typically a diversified portfolio of securities, right? So as opposed to buying the S&P 500, all 500 stocks to get, you know, the return and the risk exposure to US equities, you could buy the SPY, for example, right? So this is an ETF that tracks the S&P 500. Now, ETFs are a little different, and so this, like I said, would take a longer conversation about how they exist and liquidity is provided. But one big difference between an ETF and an index fund, right? You could also buy an index fund to track the S&P 500, is the ETF allows you to buy and sell within the day. So it trades like a stock, whereas an index fund doesn't. And you can actually short sell ETFs as well. So in many ways, it's just an alternative to an index fund, but in really important ways, in particular related to markets and market functioning, it's very different. But like I said, so if you want to learn more about that, come to Darden and I'll tell you all sorts of things about ETFs.
Well, thank you, Rich, for indulging my sort of off-script question about ETFs. I do want to talk about another very popular subject of interest, ESG investing. So this seems like, I mean, talk to prospective students who are looking at Darden, passion, you know, have this passion around impact investing, ESG, all of these kinds of things. And so what do we mean by ESG in investment?
So ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance, right? So you can imagine I pick stocks and what are the characteristics I look for? Ideally, I want stocks that will do well, so that have good returns and that have, you know, low risk. So ideally, the better the return, the lower the risk, the more excited I am. ESG investing, you can think about it two different ways. It could, you know, I think one camp or train of thought about ESG investing is that if I look at environmental, social, and governance factors, those are really important dimensions of both return and risk. So that's one way to think about it. Now, there's an alternative which says, I care about return, I care about risk, but even if it doesn't contribute to return or decrease risk, you know, I have a moral obligation through my investing to take into account and invest according to my values as they relate to the environment, to, you know, the society in which we live, and into the governance of these companies we invest in. So ESG investing is thinking about, you know, the universe of assets from the perspective of these three dimensions. So I think one big topic lately has been carbon neutrality. So you think about, I've got this portfolio, I invest in all these companies. As companies strive to become carbon neutral, it's possible that, you know, if investors prefer that type of company, they may actually have easier access to capital, right? And there may be a real benefit for firms as they adopt ESG principles. Now, so I think about ESG and how you implement it in a portfolio. And this is a discussion we have both in the investments and the quantitative portfolio management class. And so one example would be this CalPERS case I have. So CalPERS is the California Pension and Employee Retirement System. So it's one of the largest pension funds, public pension funds in the world. It's $300+ billion. And you know, you can imagine they're very transparent. And so lots of individual investors, certainly this, you know, the former employees of cities, counties, and the state of California care a lot about it. But the rest of the world looks at it too. In many ways, as CalPERS goes, many other public pensions and endowments and other institutional investors go. Anyway, so December 2003, they made an ESG choice to stop investing in tobacco. Now, it was a soft ban, so it didn't mean all tobacco was eliminated from the portfolio. Managers on the platform could still invest in it, but they basically said, let's exclude tobacco from our investments. Okay, no. So December 2003, fast forward to 2016. So some of the analysts that help run the CalPERS fund did this analysis of the performance impact of that decision, divesting from tobacco. And they found that CalPERS missed out on somewhere between 1 and 2 billion. Now, this is an estimate, right? You can't say for sure because it's the, you know, it's the counterfactual. It didn't actually happen. But you know, if they had invested in tobacco, their estimate was they would have improved performance by $1 to $2 billion. Okay, so there's this question now: should we invest in tobacco or not? So what if, you know, you have these ESG principles, you feel like it's not moral or ethical, we shouldn't be in tobacco companies, and yet tobacco does really well, right? So how do you balance your ESG principles and values with performance? And so, you know, basically the analyst came to them and said, you know, proposed possibly removing this ban. So CalPERS board analyzed it, and they actually went the opposite direction. So they made it from a soft ban to a hard ban. It said, no, we're gonna double down on the divestment, as it were. Now, recently, in the past year and a half or so, one of their board members has sued because there's this question, right? So, I mean, do those values make sense? You know, they do, maybe they do for all the CalPERS members, but there's, you know, you think about the investment mandate and their fiduciary responsibility. There may be a conflict there, right? Does your investment mandate allow you, even at the expense of return or at the expense of not improving risk, to invest in these companies? So I mean, it's a huge issue. I mean, ESG is moving forward for sure, but there's some question about how you balance those things, right? And it's we have great discussions in class about this. Is this the right thing to do? How do you do it? What do you deal with it? What's the solution to that? And once again, like I said, if you really want to know the answer to that question, I don't really have it, but we could talk about it if you came to Dart. So,
well, it sets up, I mean, Rich, an incredible panelist. You're sort of moving from one question to the next, working ahead of your host here. I wonder how you kind of, you know, I always think of Law and Order, rip from the headlines. Like, how do you pull in sort of this headline grabbing stuff? I have no doubt that in your class, when the GameStop thing started happening, or any of these like current events in finance, in the financial world started happening, people want to talk about them. How do you find space to talk about them in class? Is that something that you do?
Yes, yes. So it turns out, actually, when GameStop was going crazy, I was teaching the executive MBAs up in Roslyn. And so, you know, it popped up a couple of times in our class discussions because people were mindful of it and were thinking of it mentally as their example of whatever the case happened to be. And so they said, well, listen, let's talk about this. So we did, you know, we just did an impromptu session on a Thursday night or Friday, I think maybe it was Friday night, you know, for an hour. And we did it hybrid. So some people were in the room and other people just zoomed in. And we, you know, I kind of walked them through a short squeeze, how to think about short selling, how that works. You know, the GME and the possibility that there had been manipulative short selling, et cetera. Now, so that's one way. Now I'm actually writing a case. So for my Q4 class, quantitative portfolio management, that starts in, I don't know, 12 or 13 days, I'm writing a case on GameStop. So looking at one of the hedge funds that was short selling GameStop and think, you know, walking through their thought process and the events surrounding it, right? You know, just to give better insight into how short selling works, what the risks might be, you know, what the outside factors are, et cetera. So you get it instantaneously, like, you know, you'll find that Dart faculty are incredibly willing, because we love this stuff, we're fascinated by it, to have a conversation, a Zoom discussion, et cetera. In addition to that, you know, like I said, it's so important and such a great example, in particular of a short squeeze, that I said, let's write a case, and the case writer and I are working on it, and it'll be done before, I think April 2nd is when it's getting taught. So it better be done before April 2nd, but it will be, I promise you.
Well, let's stay with the current topics, because I noticed the Q&A is heating up, and a couple additional sort of, again, people are talking a lot about these topics. So one of the things people have asked about here is cryptocurrency as an investment, and starting to see some larger companies, larger players getting interested in cryptocurrency as a potential investment. Now, volatile investment that it is, I think we're still like learning about cryptocurrency in a lot of ways, Bitcoin and all these things. So do you have a perspective on this? Anything that you would share that you think is interesting about this trend?
I do. So when I think about cryptocurrencies, you think about three dimensions. In many ways, gold is somewhat of an analog. Now, gold has a much more liquid, less volatile market, so it's different in lots of other ways. But you think of gold, and why is gold valuable, right? Now, it's valuable because it's shiny. which is baffling. Like, why do we like shiny things? Why would we pay so much per ounce for shiny stuff? And yet we do. And in many cultures, it's actually a store of value and has been for centuries. Okay, so cryptocurrency is an investment. It's also a means of payment, right? So first and foremost, when I think about it, I think, okay, fundamentally, this will be adopted and more widely used, and there'll be increased demand for it if it becomes an important mechanism for payment. So you look at the efficiency with which cryptocurrency is mined, and you compare it to, say, for example, Visa and their ability to implement, you know, payment transactions. It's actually a relatively inefficient way to pay for things, all else considered. Like, think of number of transactions you can process in a given second, as it were. Okay, so that's concerning to some degree. At the same time, you know, the technology is improving and developing, and maybe there are better ways to enhance upon it. Maybe there's new cryptocurrencies that'll be even better, right? But that's one dimension. You got to think about it. Its fundamental underlying purpose, because that will determine largely demand for it, right? Okay, now that's one part. Now, the second part is investment, which is, okay, if you have, you know, if cryptocurrencies are the thing of the future, right? If investors are going to start going in and continue going in, right? You'd rather be the first one than the last one in terms of returns and what it's done. And the returns on, you know, Bitcoin over the past while have been unbelievable, like astonishing. Okay, so you worry about, you think about investments, you know, how is it done? At the same time, it is incredibly volatile, right? So gold, on the other hand, right, goes up, goes down. Volatility is relatively low, you know, for cryptocurrencies, and possibly because they're newer, and, you know, the volatility is incredibly high. So you think about risk return properties from an investment perspective. Also, institutional investors and their shift into or away from cryptocurrencies. That's the second dimension. And the third and final dimension is the possible regulatory impact, right? So you think, could, you know, the US government at some point change their regulation with respect to cryptocurrencies and affect dramatically its usage as an investment and or a vehicle for payment? Okay, now, so is it a good investment or not? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question, but those are the three lenses through which I think about it, right? What's the regulatory risk? What's the true investment risk? And then what's its potential and its true underlying purpose, which is as a payment, you know, transaction and mechanism vehicle.
Another conversation that it feels like it's been ongoing or certainly accelerated over recent years in the investment world is about the sort of automated investment versus actively managed funds. And I wonder if you have some thoughts on where that's going to go and, you know, what you think the most interesting trends are there.
So exchange traded funds. So I think about passive versus active, right? So active investment, I pay a manager, you know, some fee, let's think for mutual funds, expense ratios of 1% a year to actively try and beat a particular index, right? So that'd be the active strategy. Passive just says, listen, for much lower cost, I want to buy the index and whatever it happens to own, right? I don't think I of the S&P 500, I don't think I can pick the best 10 or 50 stocks. And so I'll just buy all of them proportionally. So passive, you know, that indexed or passive investment really started with Vanguard, right? One of the first mutual funds, I think it was in the 1970s. And for index funds, 1970s to, you know, it took about 30 years or so to get to 10% market share. Okay, so now fast forward, ETFs existed before, but they really took off starting in mid to late 2000s. And so 10 years, right, you get another 10% market share. And in US markets, we're about at 50% of passive versus active kind of ownership. I think a lot of what you've seen in the massive bull market that we've experienced over the past, you know, 9 or 10 years, maybe not a lot, but some contributing factor for sure is the rise of passive indexed investment, right? So most of these indices are market cap weighted. So when I buy them, I'm putting the most amount of money in the largest stocks. And you'll notice it's those mega cap stocks in general that have done so well over the past 8, 9, 10 years. Now, will that trend continue forever? There is a point at which there's so much passive that the opportunities, think of them as arbitrage or mispricing opportunities for active investors, start to increase, right? If everyone stops looking for mispricing, that's when mispricing arises. And, I mean, the opposite of that is, you know, I tell in class often the joke about the hedge fund manager and the academic. So there's a professor who's walking down the street, hedge fund manager is walking about 10 steps behind him in New York. And as he's walking along, the professor passes right by a $100 bill, just keeps walking. Right. And this hedge fund manager is like, and so he picks up the $100 and runs up to catch the professor and says, "Hey, you just walked by this $100 bill." To which the professor responds, "No, if there was a $100 bill on the ground, somebody would have picked it up." Right. So it's searching for those arbitrage opportunities and mispricing is what makes them go away. I mean, that's sort of it's in some ways having more passive and less people looking for mispricing is more likely to generate. So there's an equilibrium between those two. You know, where exactly is that equilibrium point? I'm not sure, but I think we're getting, you know, passive is growing pretty dramatically. At some point, active, I think, will rebound.
All right. Well, I want to give some airtime here as well to talk about the Mayo Center. You do a lot with this particular center at the Darden School. I think you were recently involved in a conference not so long ago. As we talked about potential dates for this session, you said, "Hey, can we pick a date in early March?" Because I'm surprise on another panel leading a discussion. So, what is the Mayo Center, and you know what's exciting to you about having this resource at the Darden School?
So the Richard A. Mayo Center for Asset Management, one of our centers of excellence here at Darden. So Dick Mayo is an alum of ours. He's one of the founding members of Grantham Mayo and Van Otterloo, and then started his own long short hedge fund. And he's an incredible guy. He's one of my favorite people on the face of the earth, and has been incredibly generous with the school. So he really wants and believes in Darden's mission, not just to, you know, do academic research that doesn't matter, but really to be the intersection of academic research, practice, and pedagogy, right? Teaching people about these things. And so he funded this center, which generates case writing. One of the things that we do for it, so this conference you mentioned that we just ran, we partner with the Investment Company Institute. So it's an industry organization that represents mutual funds, Investment Company Act of 1940 funds. So mutual funds all over the US and the world for that matter. And we bring practitioners and academics and regulators to have conversations, hard conversations about some of the topics that we find, right? And so it's this last one we had, so the first of the two sessions, and both of them, by the way, if you want to take a look at the conversations we had, the keynote that was given, et cetera, on the Mayo Center, both of those conferences, I think the video for both of them is posted. But the first of those two is actually about diversity and inclusion. And so the fireside chat, the keynote speech, was a 30-minute conversation between myself and Melody Hobson, who's the co-CEO of Ariel Investments. Now, Ariel manages, you know, I think $14 or $15 billion in assets, but it's actually one of the most diverse asset management firms in the world, whether you think about it in terms of employees or firm ownership. And she is amazing. I could have talked to her for hours. Like her perspective on the value of diversity and how diversity and inclusion, what you really need to do to make it effective in corporate America it's really profound. Now, it's not just being a co-CEO, right? She's on the board. In fact, I think she's the incoming chair of Starbucks. She's been on JP Morgan's board. So anyway, I highly encourage you to go take a look at it. It'll give you a great sense of what the Mayo Center does, the kind of conversations and learning that it tries to generate.
Well, thank you, Rich. We'll always take a plug for another webinar in a webinar. Always a popular way to score points with your webinar host. So so for students interested in a finance career, what is your pitch for them as to why Darden, or why should someone interested in that professional path consider Darden?
Yeah, I really think there are tools, right? And almost any place that the teaching of those tools, right? So CAPM, valuation of a firm, it's commoditized, right? In fact, you don't even necessarily need to go to an MBA program, right? You can find amazing online courses at Khan Academy and Coursera to do the pure technical stuff. What you want is investment and, you know, decision-making skills, right? So in finance, right, you're either agreeing to invest in something or providing capital to a firm and, you know, or deciding on a project, right? Should we fund this project or that project? So the tools themselves, learning about that, commoditized, you can get that anywhere. The reason you come here is because after you've learned that skill, you come to class and we try and put you, whether it's the, you know, case method or Darden Capital Management, where literally you're using millions of dollars to make purchase and sale decisions, right? And you live with the consequences of those decisions. So in everything we try and do, you know, we understand table stakes is knowing how to do the quantitative, the actual calculation. What really will set you ahead in your career and going forward is your ability to make business decisions, right? As a function of those principles, right? And the business decisions are messier. It's never as clean or clear as the pure numerical problem, right? Once you get this information, you still have to decide good idea, bad idea. And there's so many factors, right? So that's the reason you come to Dart. The other stuff, table stakes. You can get that anywhere.
Well, we'll say, I mean, one of the things that we always talk with students about is, you know, you're going to be an active participant in your learning experience. You're going to come and you're not only going to learn from the faculty here, you're going to learn from your classmates. And, you know, that also tends to mean you're engaged outside of the classroom. We have over 50 student organizations, certainly something we've talked about a lot on the podcast. Hopefully our listeners and viewers here on this webinar have already found our two admissions podcasts, Executive MBA podcast and Experience Darden podcast. So Rich, one of the really interesting things that does come up on the podcast as we talk with our first year and second year students is the extent to which they get to know faculty outside of the classroom and this sort of interaction, and that this is, you know, this is part of the Darden experience. I wonder, what does that look like for you, and how do you get to know students outside the classroom?
So the nice thing about Charlottesville is it's this really beautiful place. So I imagine, you know, things are a little different right now with the pandemic and limitations on interactions, but generally speaking, you know, the faculty offices are right next to the classrooms. Everybody likes to be on campus. We have these beautiful green spaces and, you know, it's really a spectacular campus. And so what are the interactions? So Darden Capital Management for me was a big one, right? So you spend a lot of time. And even though I'm no longer the advisor, I still do these teach-ins for them, right? So I'll talk to them about short selling or exchange traded funds or these other things that I have expertise in so they can, you know, improve their investing skills as a result. But a bigger part of that is just the connections that occur, you know, as I meet them here. And you know, I finished teaching my investments class yesterday and I told the students, and I meant it. I said, I want you to stay in touch, right? In the future, you're going to have investing questions. And I love this stuff. I think about it all the time. I love talking about it. So whatever you do, make sure you reach out and ask me. I'll be an unbiased source. I don't make any money from your decision either way. And that's unusual in the financial services industry. So I may be a great source of information. So, you know, the nice thing too about this Darden experience, we have all these built-in mechanisms. So we used to every year auction off a basketball game of faculty versus the students. We didn't do it this year, obviously, for pandemic reasons, but now we would get crushed, right? Because we have these, you know, NCAA level athletes. And so one year that the scoreboard was broken, so I think it was like 44-14 was the final score, but the four of the 44 looked like a one. So it looked like we tied. I think that was the year that we did the best of the bunch, but.
So Rich, I'm going to try to get one more question in here before I ask her any sort of advice, sort of last thoughts from you. So I was listening to Marketplace, the NPR program, yesterday, talking about what's going on with the stock market, talking about sort of what people's views are in inflation and what's going on with monetary policy and the Fed. We got a question here about sort of monetary policy, generally speaking, the Fed not overly concerned about inflation. Where do you see things going with ETFs in the midst of all of this? And, you know, what is sort of this economic recovery and where we are as a country, particularly with respect to the Fed?
Yeah, great question. So I do this exercise. We actually look at a forecasting model in the investments course, where we try and predict what the market will do. And it turns out, you know, the R squared, right? So your ability to, you know, better than just random guess, forecasting 1 year out is really pretty low. Okay, so I'm gonna give you my take on it, but the caveat is my forecast is worth exactly what everybody listening to the podcast is getting today. That's how good we are at this. Now, I think markets are expensive. At the same time, we've seen from previous, previous market experiences and for good economic reasons that bubbles can persist for an extended period of time. So I think the market is rich, right? So how rich, that depends. Earnings are going to be great, right? You put all the stimulus into the economy, and it's not just 1.9 trillion we're talking about now. I think there's still a trillion of the original stimulus that hasn't been fully parsed out and is in the economy. That's stimulus like we've never seen before. So that is, in many ways, I have a hard time imagining, even though we've seen, you know, some market reactions, some, you know, I don't know, profit taking the past few days as concerns about inflation have risen. I have a hard time imagining in the short term, the market goes down substantially, especially if that 1.9 trillion passes, which I think it's likely to in some form, because that stimulus will continue to drive, right? I mean, it's literally, you're juicing the economy in serious ways. Now, the real question is what happens year from now, year and a half from now, 2 years from now, at what point does that stop working, right? The car runs out of gas, and where does the car stop? Because like I said, I think valuations are rich. What we're seeing today is, you know, it's we're in expensive territory, as it were, but it can go up in particular because, you know, whether it's animal spirits and or the stimulus, you know, these things can persist and for an extended period of time.
All right. Well, something yet again to keep our eye on and to watch for here. So some of our viewers today may feel like, gosh, man, I'm jazzed about finance. I want to learn more. Are there any tips, suggestions, books, resources you recommend to people who want to learn a little bit more, kind of dive a bit deeper into this area?
Yeah. So one of my favorite books is written by Burton Malkiel, who is an economist. I think he's from Princeton. But called Random Walk Down Wall Street. And so it characterizes a pretty safe and efficient perspective on investing, right? So if you're thinking, I have money, what do I do with it? What's the right way? Which stock do I buy? It turns out that some of those are not the right question at the end of the day. And so his perspective, I think, for people wanting an introduction to markets, to think broadly about how you might manage a portfolio, at a minimum, as a framework to think about managing your portfolio, that's a great book. Now, over the years, there are a bunch of these, you know, actual market events that occur and books that are written about them. And so one of my favorite, and I know this is old, right? So most people listening to podcasts won't even remember this, but in the late 90s, there was a hedge fund called Long-Term Capital Management. It was run by some Nobel Prize winners and a bunch of Wall Street folks that almost caused, you know, a global financial crisis. So it melted down in a spectacular way. And so there's a book called When Genius Fails that kind of walks you through their arbitrage strategies, what they did, how they did it, their relationships, and then how this thing imploded at the end. That is fascinating reading. Like, it's really enjoyable. And then I think you think about our modern banking system, right? Investment banks, commercial banks, The House of Morgan by Ron Chernow. I love Ron Chernow's books, period, right? I mean, they're always way too long and a little bit too in-depth at the end of the day, but it's a fascinating perspective. Right? So just learning about Morgan and his life and his business legacy and how much of Wall Street and what it looks like today was influenced basically by his machinations. So it's an awesome book and one that I think if you're thinking about finance and modern financial systems, it's a worthwhile history to read.
Rich, I want to thank you for taking time out of a busy schedule to be here. It's been such a pleasure.
You're so welcome.
And that was my conversation with Darden faculty member, Rich Evans. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at Darden, that's D-A-R-D-E-N, at virginia.edu. Until next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.